Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. For all of you watching on Facebook, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, I'm here in our studio live, and we're video streaming. Very shortly, we'll be video streaming also every day on Progressive Radio Network as well as YouTube. That'll come in the next week. Why watch this? Why listen in? Because this is the one program that will deal with issues that impact us and empower us. Everything from what's going on in Borneo, one of the largest islands in the world, and yet it's decimated. We don't know about it. This program will inform you. What about the dangers of vaccines, especially mandatory vaccines where your child must take them? What about the bad science behind those vaccines? We'll explain it. We are the one place that does not deal in propagandizing, but we look at where propaganda has influences and we make a difference. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, you'll see it. On Friday, you'll hear it. Today, we're going to talk about even moderate drinking is dangerous and could lead to dementia, and six reasons you should be eating more cucumbers, and also we're going to look at curcumin, what it can do in your body, and a lot more on health and healing. Also today, we're going to go to our video archives. You'll have a chance to hear some climate change people who believe that climate change is a fraud. They are what you might call climate change deniers. That's their right. And some make very persuasive arguments, except, well, as you'll see, for each argument they make that shows that climate change isn't real and we don't have to worry and we don't have to change, we don't have to commit ourselves to lowering our carbon footprint, all share real specific facts based upon quality science that not only are they wrong, but our entire planet is in jeopardy right now. In fact, it's so bad that I'm going to ask our audience around the world to pay attention to the Arctic over the next 2.5 to 3 months. If in the next 2 to 3 months the Arctic goes completely ice-free, you've got a countdown to disaster that will be happening because with the ocean not having the ability to reflect sun back off ice and snow, you then are going to see methane release and global warming increase. What can we do about it? I'll give you positive solutions that individually and collectively we can do. But for those who say, gee, Gary, why don't you have on someone who will challenge you? I'm not having one person on. I'm having two. Two of the most popular, respected, and people who are, in effect, opinion leaders. So I'm giving their opportunity today, uninterrupted, unedited. You'll hear what their arguments, and then I'll have a chance to respond. Also today, for the person in our audience named Michael. Michael, you sent me an email, and the email said, listen to his presentation and see where it can be challenged. And then he goes on to say, this could refute your information, Dr. G. So we looked into this professor emeritus, who, quote, you say, has no political ties or funding or any hidden agenda. This is all the time what I see on the internet. Well, this is what scholarship does. It shows you, is that the truth? Or is there information this person's not aware of? So I'll give you that. I have a guest in the second part of our program, two guests today, and this is going to be a new part of our program. On a regular weekly basis, I intend to have a person on that I personally work with who had a medically irreversible condition and that would have ultimately led into their death, and how using lifestyle, including diet, and behavior modification, including de-stressing, and re-examining why they're alive. Surely we're alive for more than just going to school, getting a degree, going to work, having a family, and dying, and consuming everything we can in the interim. There has to be a more important spiritual legacy to our existence. So for all of you out there, I'll share what those people have learned and how they're now living a different life. Today, you're going to hear from Kenny. Kenny was a part of a group that took about 16 months, but he was terminal. Today he is completely cured. You'll hear it, his own words, uncoached, unrehearsed, and he'll tell you how he did it. If he could do it, you can do it. My guest today will be from the Netherlands on Skype, so you have a chance to see him as well as hear him. And he is Chris Casper de Ploeg, and he is a Dutch political analyst and a journalist, and he is also belongs to the Authentic Journalism Platform in the Netherlands, and they focused on the history of the current events in the Ukraine. Now, we've all been told, and with absolute certainty, that Russia interfered and invaded, their army invaded the Ukraine, and they're responsible for all the carnage in that area. There's no proof of that. Just to the contrary. It was the United States, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and their neocons who staged a coup in a democratically elected president, threw him out, and got neo-fascists in their place, but people we could do business with. So you're going to hear the truth from a scholar who has studied it, researched, been there, instead of one of the wonking, tonking heads on CNN. So you see, we have a lot to share. Let's begin. It was in the 1970s, I wrote a book called Alcohol Nutrition. It's out of print now. And in it, I argued that any amount of alcohol is dangerous. But the higher the level of alcohol, let's say 50%, 80%, 100%, the more damage it does. To give you an example, an average glass of alcohol, like the ones you see advertised on television, can kill over 1 million heart cells, kidney cells, liver cells, and brain cells per drink. Now, when I was going to college, at least the first college I went to and graduated from, it was a relatively conservative environment. Of course, people went out and drank. Generally, they drank beer, and which was a low alcohol content, so you didn't really get drunk, and they used it in their social environment. It was considered unseemly to get drunk, at least where I went to school and in the group of people in that environment. It was a business college. You went there to get your degree in business administration, business management. Later, at other schools that I attended to get my undergraduate, graduate, doctorate, and postdoctoral work, it was a different environment. Then it was you as an individual chose to drink or not. Today, everywhere across the United States and the vast majority of campuses, men and women equal will binge drink. And we're not talking about going out and socially drinking. You have a drink. Okay? Have a glass of red wine. That's not going to hurt you. But unless you drink a lot of wine, then it will. And they're drinking hard alcohol and sometimes having 4 to 10 drinks. So just imagine how much damage they're doing to their DNA. So they may be 20 years old and a sophomore or junior in college, but their liver, kidneys, heart, and brain are much older, double that. So let's say that you binge drink for 4 years in college or more. By the time you graduate, you're halfway through your body's lifespan genetically. That's how bad it's gotten. And I'm seeing troves of young people in their late 30s and 40s who have chronic fatigue, who have liver conditions, kidney conditions, heart conditions. And they shouldn't, because your body should ideally live to about 150 years. That's ideal. Realistically, most people, if they lived correctly, should live 105 to 110 years in pretty ideal health, meaning they're not at a loss for exercising. They could exercise. They could have a good sex life. They could be vital. In fact, at an upcoming point, I will talk about vitalism and a big movement that has been throughout history where a few people have believed in vitalism. Hippocrates, the father of medicine, was a vitalist. Voltaire was a vitalist. Thoreau was vitalist. Walt Whitman was a vitalist. We've always had vitalists. The Essenes, one of the ancient tribes of Israel, were vitalist. Today, we don't have a vitalistic movement. Some people are in the raw food. Some people are into juicing. Some people are macrobiotic. Some of this is vital, but your whole life has to be vital, meaning not just your diet. In any case, the conclusion of the book showed that if you drink, you pay a price, even though when you wake up the next day, with or without a hangover, You won't appreciate how much of a price you paid until later. My mother gave me some advice early in life. She was just a normal person in our community, but she had an unusual amount of common sense, as a lot of mothers do. And that's one of the reasons that we treasure our mothers. They're very special, all of us. And she said, you will only know whether or not you have made good decisions when you finally get to a destination. And this was in the context of her telling me I should leave my hometown that I loved growing up in, a small hometown, no different than most people's small neighborhoods anywhere in America, because you grow up with the people you're familiar with. You think you're going to be friends for life. There's a familiarity. There's a comfort. There's an ease by which you live. And she was giving me examples of why, after graduating high school, I should leave my hometown and go to a place like New York, where even the thought of New York, the tallest building in my hometown was one building, I think, was 7 stories tall. It was rather overwhelming. And then she gave me examples of people who I'd grown up with and knew who didn't pay attention to what the consequence would be of the choices they made. And she's, now look at such and such, our good neighbor, and one of your buddy's fathers. He's an alcoholic. He's always sick. And he can't enjoy his life because he made choices to drink. And he's not dealing with the issues. And she went through all these other people. And she says, so from the outside, everyone may look normal. They may look fine. But you're not in that house. You're not seeing what they do every day. So think about the choices you make in life. And if you want to get a short-term gain, are you going to be able to live with that later on in life? And that was the comment. Don't be impulsive. Don't just act out from some form of desire for instant gratification. Think about what you do, because there's going to be a consequence, either good or bad. That said, I saw the impact of drinking in my community. I then saw it in the people who I befriended in New York. And it's devastating. It's a major killer. And yet no one paid attention, because the argument was, well, there's studies showing that drinking moderately, you know, 1 or 2 glasses of alcohol a day is going to be good for you. It'll help your heart. I've actually counseled people. I counseled a major lawyer down on Wall Street who is deadly ill, come from his cardiologist. And when I was going over his diet, it was supposed to be a good diet. It was a terrible diet. And then he was told by his cardiologist to have 2 glasses of alcohol a day. He did, bourbon, 80% alcohol. No wonder his liver wasn't functioning. His enzymes were off the chart. No wonder he had problems with his kidneys and killing the nephron cells and tubules in the kidneys. No wonder he had congestive heart failure. No wonder at the age of 52, he was suffering from beginning of dementia. He'd killed these cells by the billions upon hundreds of billions. Still, no one listened. After all, if you go to a party, you expect to socialize. You want to socialize? You want to be around people? Fine. Who says that you can't socialize and have fun without drinking? I love the disco scene. I was out there dancing all the time. Studio 54, and one of my buddies owned almost all the discos in New York. Underground, Infinity, Bonds, New York. He owned all of them. And so I had great places to go and dance. And I had a lot of friends that went with me. We didn't do drugs. We didn't do the alcohol. We did do the music. And it was fun. So the next day, you get up, you've danced, you've enjoyed yourself, you socialize, but your liver isn't hurt, your stomach isn't hurt, because you want to kill your stomach, you want to create colorectal cancer, stomach cancer, drink alcohol. That'll do it. You want to burn your esophagus and end up with ulcerations of your esophagus, drink alcohol. Again, no one listened. Well, guess what? Here's today. University of Oxford, as well as University of College London, quote, published in the British Medical Journal, even moderate drinking linked to a decline in brain health. Alcohol consumption, even at modern levels, is associated with an increased risk of adverse brain outcomes and steeper decline in cognition and mental skills. These results support the recent reduction in alcohol guidance in the United Kingdom and raise questions about the current limits recommended in the United States. So, any drinking of alcohol is bad. So let's go back to 1974. It was right then. The science is right today, plus a whole lot of people's experience. Don't think that social drinking is not going to hurt you. It could kill you and increase your risk of diabetes, because remember, alcohol is converted at a higher level of calories, double that of protein and carbohydrates. You get twice as many calories created in the body from the same amount of grams of alcohol as you do from them. So you're putting on a lot of calories. Diabetes, hypertension, congestive heart failure, macular degeneration, glaucoma, cataracts, impotence, all that can come. So good news is, what should we consume that's good for us? Well, here's the good news. Cucumbers. Now, most people are not going to eat cucumbers. They should, but you can juice them. In fact, I recommend one of the great tonics of life is cucumber juice with celery and green apple. Now, you can vary that. You could have cucumber, celery, and ginger, lemon, and lime. You can have cucumber and green apple and grapefruit, which is terrific for you. And by the way, always juice the skin and the seeds of the grapefruit, because of caprylic acid and limonene, which is a very important anti-cancer phytonutrient, which is in the skin of lemons. And also it's good you have different oils in the skin of oranges. Now, you want to buy organic. If not, then use a good cleaner, like a veggie wash, where you spray it on, scrub it off. But you have immediate varieties, but using cucumber as your base. Why? Here's something a lot of people are juicing or not may not be aware of. Juicing gives you more servings of fruits and vegetables than eating them, because there's only so much you can eat. I mean, reasonably speaking, a person might be able to consume 2 apples in a day. Most people, it's 1. But you could easily take the juice of 4 apples, including the skin, where all your polyphenols are and your quercetin is, which helps protect your blood vessels, helps keep your skin tight and smooth. And you could have that in a 12-ounce glass of juice. And 12-ounce glass of juice is easy as can be to drink. So juicing is where you can get a real head start on rebuilding, repairing, and detoxifying your DNA. So let's just talk about the cucumber today. Here are some of the things it can do. First, it's very low in calories, but it's good in fiber. It's even got proteins. Most people never consider protein, but you're getting protein and magnesium, lots of vitamin K. But what else does it do? Well, it's high in water content, and that's a diluting factor, and our bodies are generally dehydrated. And as you dehydrate, one of the very first things you'll notice when you get dehydrated, pain. One of the ways I help people overcome pain, lower back pain, muscle pain, cramps, is hydration with electrolytes. Generally, a combination of watermelon juice with the seeds juiced, and mix that half and half with coconut water, high in potassium. So when you're replacing the electrolytes and you're giving potassium and magnesium, you're relaxing the muscles, flushing out the lymphatic system, and are in less pain. So less pain, cucumber juice. Also contains really good antioxidants that trap free radicals, and it promotes hydration. And we need to be more hydrated. Almost everyone we give an impedance test to, which measures the percentage of your body hydration, they're dehydrated. So you need to have enough water in your tissues. It aids in weight loss. It helps lower your blood sugar. In fact, one good way to help anyone who's got an elevated, let's say, fasting blood sugar level, should be in the 70s, maybe in the 80s, but not higher. When people say, oh, Gary, my blood sugar is pretty good. It was 300, but now it's 120. You're still diabetic. That's not good. So you want to get it down below 90, ideally below 80. Anyhow, taking your juice in the morning, cucumber and celery juice with pomegranate, that will help lower that blood sugar substantially. And it also really promotes regularity. If you have constipation, I suggest you take a quarter teaspoon of buffered vitamin C, put it in your 12-ounce glass of juice and drink that down. That helps stimulate peristalsis, which is the wave-like breathing movement of your intestines, so your body cleanses itself. Remember, the health of your body begins in your intestine. the probacteria, the good bacteria, good fiber, and then fiber from nuts and seeds, legumes and pulses, fruits, and the best fruits for fiber would be blueberries, cherries. Those are your two best. In fact, cherries help make a person regular. And the rule in life is for a meal that you eat, the debris of a meal, along with that debris, is dead bacteria, no longer good, and dead cells. Through mitosis, you're moving about 1 to 1.5% of your body cells a day out of your body. So you cleanse out, which is great. You hydrate, which is terrific. And then you re-energize by what you take in. So that's all good. And also from our environmental segment today, we have that continued use of glyphosate herbicide in the European Union called into question by renowned toxicologists. This is from Beyond Pesticides. Quote, following the recent proposal of a 10-year extension for the approval of glyphosate use in the European Union, internationally recognized toxicologist Dr. Christopher Portier has delivered a letter to the European Commission, which, by the way, is what oversees the scientific findings in this. And Portier was the former associate director of the National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences and the director of the Office of Risk Assessment Research. So he's at the very highest level of American scientific society. And he's saying unequivocally, absolutely, stop. The science is not on the side of glyphosate, which is Roundup, the fertilizer, the pesticide. It is against people's health. The studies are overwhelming. Did you hear any of this on any of the media? No. But I bet you saw some ads for that weed killer. Oh, in my driveway, I use Roundup. That's Monsanto, the same people that gave us Agent Orange and a lot of other toxic materials. So for those of you now listening from the European Union, and a lot of people are listening, I was told over 180 countries, people are listening to this broadcast each day, contact your representative, write letters of protest to the European Union to ban glyphosate completely and also ban neonicotinoids. Why? Because neonicotinoids now have been shown to be the leading cause of bee colony collapse. Now, I've raised bees my entire adult life. For those of you who are new to this, you would not know that I'm an organic farmer, a certified organic farmer. I teach farming. I teach homesteading. I teach people how to be natural conservationists and ecologists, and keeping bees is a part of that. Well, 1/3 of all the produce that we consume in America comes from pollination of bees. So just imagine taking away 1/3 of all of our selection because of bee colony collapse. Now, you don't have bee colony collapse. You have bees thriving when you have organic. So they're foraging where there's no sprays, no electromagnetic towers, cell phone towers that disrupt their normal navigational systems. They thrive. Put them under the stress of how they're commercialized, and they die. In some cases, 50% collapse in 1 year. So ban neonicotinoids. They shouldn't be used. Now, that's the latest on health and nutrition and aging. And tomorrow I'm going to talk about Lyme's disease, all new information to really give you an insight, because there's a lot of myths about, and I help a lot of people with Lyme's disease. It's not that difficult. And also tomorrow on our environmental segment, I'm going to do a commentary, extensive commentary, on taking one place on Earth, Borneo, and that's in Indonesia, and I'm going to show you how this, one of the three largest islands in the world, is now completely destroyed. You're talking about a huge island destroyed. And I'm going to take you through what goes on there in a given day by people who live there to show you that while we're talking about climate change and helping the climate, anyone who can exploit a situation for their advantage by taking out of the ground precious metals, also tearing down forests, especially the old hardwood forest, by ripping out the Amazon trees that have very little topsoil. I went down to Brazil and Venezuela. I wanted to see for myself what was going on. And if you went out to Kansas, you could put your whole hand in the ground and you still wouldn't hit a rock bed. Not true in the Amazon. Maybe 1 to 2 inches of topsoil, that's it. So that's why all the root systems go out instead of down. And that's why they just go in there with these giant chains. I'm talking about links that are huge, and they put a giant tractor over there and a giant tractor here, and then just take these two tractors down a field, and every tree, everything just gets pushed out, and then they put them into big piles, burn them. Then they go in there and level it off and put genetically engineered soybeans that are going to be shipped to countries, including China and Japan, to feed their cattle and pigs, because they have an affluent and growing and educated population that wants what we have. So our lifestyle is one of the contributing factors that's being leading to global warming. So I'm going to give you that tomorrow. So that's coming at you tomorrow. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. A lot of people can't listen live or watch live, so you can go to our archives. Let me give you a phone number if you happen to be out and about and can't get to your computer. Needless to say, most people just go to their computer and download a program from ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com or PRN.com. If you forget that, GaryNall.com. And you can go to the archives. Or if you're out and about anywhere in America or Canada, you can call from any, let's say, cell phone or a landline, and you can listen to up to 5 programs over the archives, and our archives are free. Here's the number you call. Please write this down, 701-719-9976. Again, 701-719-9976. But let's say you're out and about and you want to listen live. It's noon, Monday to Friday, 5 days a week, noon to 1 Eastern Standard Time. You can hear this program and watch it for those days. The Fridays, by the way, I have so much editing to do on my new films that I do the radio program from a different studio that's not set up with all the technology and cameras. So I'll still do the show every Friday live, but you just will hear it. You won't, at least until the editing is finished, and I'll let you know when that film is coming out later. Very hard-hitting program that you're going to see in this new film, hopefully in August. In any case, here's the number you can call in and listen live. If you're out and about, if you're in a cab, car, we have truckers who call and listen. Put it on the speaker and you listen. 712-775-6850. 712-775-6850. Now we're going to, before we go to our guest, I'm going to play a piece here, The Inconvenient Truth About the Democratic Party, because I believe, and I'm sure many of you do, that there was a time when the Democratic Party represented unions, represented the poor, represented fair wages, represented protection of the environment, represented anti-war, protesting. Not today. It's completely changed. Please listen in and watch.
When you think about racial equality and civil rights, which political party comes to mind? The Republicans or the Democrats? Most people would probably say the Democrats, but this answer is incorrect. Since its founding in 1829, the Democratic Party has fought against every major civil rights initiative and has a long history of discrimination. The Democratic Party defended slavery, started the Civil War, opposed Reconstruction, founded the Ku Klux Klan, imposed segregation, perpetrated lynchings, and fought against the Civil Rights Acts of the 1950s and 1960s. In contrast, the Republican Party was founded in 1854 as an anti-slavery party. Its mission was to stop the spread of slavery into the new Western territories with the aim of abolishing it entirely. This effort, however, was dealt a major blow by the Supreme Court in the 1857 case, Dred Scott versus Sandfoot. The court ruled that slaves aren't citizens, they're property. The seven justices who voted in favor of slavery, all Democrats. The two justices who dissented, both Republicans. The slavery question was, of course, ultimately resolved by a bloody civil war. The commander-in-chief during that war was the first Republican president, Abraham Lincoln, the man who freed the slaves. 6 days after the Confederate Army surrendered, John Wilkes Booth, a Democrat, assassinated President Lincoln. Lincoln's vice president, a Democrat named Andrew Johnson, assumed the presidency. But Johnson adamantly opposed Lincoln's plan to integrate the newly freed slaves into the South's economic and social order. Johnson and the Democratic Party were unified in their opposition to the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery, the 14th Amendment, which gave blacks citizenship, and the 15th Amendment, which gave blacks the vote. All three passed only because of universal Republican support. During the era of Reconstruction, federal troops stationed in the South helped secure rights for the newly freed slaves. Hundreds of black men were elected to Southern state legislatures as Republicans, and 22 black Republicans served in the U.S. Congress by 1900. The Democrats did not elect a black man to Congress until 1935. But after Reconstruction ended, when the federal troops went home, Democrats roared back into power in the South. They quickly reestablished white supremacy across the region with measures like black codes, laws that restricted the ability of blacks to own property and run businesses, and they imposed poll taxes and literacy tests used to subvert black citizens' right to vote. And how was all of this enforced? By terror, much of it instigated by the Ku Klux Klan, founded by a Democrat, Nathan Bedford Forrest. As historian Eric Foner, himself a Democrat, notes, in effect, the Klan was a military force serving the interests of the Democratic Party. President Woodrow Wilson, a Democrat, shared many views with the Klan. He resegregated many federal agencies and even screened the first movie ever played at the White House, the racist film, The Birth of a Nation, originally entitled The Klansman. A few decades later, the only serious congressional opposition to the landmark Civil Rights Act of 1964 came from Democrats. 80% of Republicans in Congress supported the bill, less than 70% of Democrats did. Democratic senators filibustered the bill for 75 days until Republicans mustered the few extra votes needed to break the logjam. And when all of their efforts to enslave blacks, keep them enslaved, and then keep them from voting had failed, the Democrats came up with a new strategy. If black people are going to vote, they might as well vote for Democrats, as President Lyndon Johnson was purported to have said about the Civil Rights Act, I'll have them voting Democrat for 200 years. So now, the Democratic Party prospers on the votes of the very people it has spent much of its history oppressing. Democrats falsely claim that the Republican Party is the villain, when in reality, it's the failed policies of the Democratic Party that have kept blacks down. Massive government welfare has decimated the black family. Opposition to school choice has kept them trapped in failing schools. Politically correct policing has left black neighborhoods defenseless against violent crime. So when you think about racial equality and civil rights, which political party should come to mind? I'm Carol Swain, professor of political science and law at Vanderbilt University for Prager University.
That's one point of view. Historically, that person is correct. But today, I say both parties are racist. Both parties discriminate. Both parties are anti-environment. Both parties are anti-human rights. Both parties are warmongers. Both parties are controlled by a higher power, the neocons, the fascists, the oligarchs. So we have to stop thinking Democrat, Republican, liberal, and conservative. We have to start thinking in humanistic and populist. Who is there to serve the public? not the institution. Now let's go over to, I believe he is in New Jersey. Well, we're going to get one of our guests in a moment here. When we get him, I'll let you know. I wanted to talk about some of the organizations that are helping the world and some that are not. And for the person that wrote me recently and said, what about such and such? He did a video, and it's very compelling, except no one looked at this person's background. I was told, quote, this person has no political ties, no funding or other hidden agendas. Here's what we found. This person named Easterbrook, who is respected on by a lot of the people within the political apparatus of Washington and the media, he's deeply connected to the Koch brothers and the fossil fuel industry, which funds the Heartland Institute, and he has been a speaker at the Tea Party rallies. His main book, Evidence-Based Climate Change, relies mostly on climate change deniers and many who are scientists in disciplines unrelated to climatology. And Eastbrook himself is a geologist, not an atmospheric scientist. His own words and societies that he talks about belongs to are geological. None are climate-based. He believes that the Paris Conference is a plot to establish a world socialist government. Well, that is certainly not true. So the next time you suggest I have someone on the program because they're not affiliated, well, do your homework. He is. He has a right to his points of view, and he's a good articulate spokesman for them. But he falls, in my personal opinion, as a climate denier. Now let's go to Kenny, who's standing by. Hi, Kenny.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Good. Kenny, you are the first in a new series that we're doing, and we're going to have a person per week. And I'd like for you to tell your story about your condition, how advanced it was, what your neurologist, team of board-certified neurologists, said to you was the likely outcome, so that people have appreciation of how far you've come from that day to now.
Okay, Gary. Well, in 2008, I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and they found that out through a series of MRIs and a spinal tap. They said to me that I would have to inject myself with the drug for the rest of my life. They said to me that I would have to prepare my family and build a ramp up to my house because eventually I would become disabled. And that left me with the really dark feeling of despair and no other options that I didn't like. And hence I reached out to you and your team, went to your support group, and my body responded to the lifestyle changes immediately. Now, that was almost 10 years ago, and I'm looking at close to going on 9 years symptom-free, completely symptom-free, from following the lifestyle and taking advantage of all the changes that I had to implement from the support group. So for anyone out there that's going through the pain in their body and not being able to walk up a set of stairs, like I had trouble walking up the steps to the first support group. My wife at the time had to help me walk up the steps. I couldn't make it on my own. You could definitely do it, and there's hope for sure, 2,000%. You just have to take the initiative and grab the bull by the horns and follow through with the appropriate action, and then you'll see how quickly your body responds.
Kenny, when
all the changes.
You were in the program for over 16 months. What were the thoughts of the neurologists, two different neurologists, when you went back and you were not in a wheelchair, you were not in any way infirm, you were completely healthy? What were their responses after they did another evaluation?
Well, you know what? The responses were identical, and they were, well, I guess you didn't have it in the first place.
Well, then why didn't you say, well, now I can sue you for malpractice for diagnosing and treating a condition I didn't have? You can't have it both ways. You can't have two separate groups of neurologists say you have multiple sclerosis and they've done a spinal tap and they've done MRIs and see the demyelinization of your nervous system, and then on your own, without their injections and without their fatal medical model, you reverse it. They can't then say, because this is the simple answer, all these people here who had terminal cancer, went through chemotherapy, radiation surgery, comes back, doctors say, go to hospice care and prepare your life to end it, for the end. And then they try something different, radically different, and they rejuvenate their body. And 2 years later, they go back, and the doctor says, well, you must not have had it. Well, if I didn't have it, then you were giving me chemotherapy and radiation and surgery for something I didn't have. What exactly did you take out of my body when you opened me up? You just opened me up and charged me $50,000 or something? The insanity of this is, the corruption of this, the violation of human ethics of this, is that the medical community has failed when it comes to serious diseases, and they should have the humility to ask those of us who are actually getting good results, what are we doing? Hold it to a high-level challenge, and let us bring all those people, the thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who have changed and improved, before them. And they're not doing that. So I'm not confident that the medical paradigm is capable of any form of self-evaluation or self-revelation. I believe that people just have to decide, do they really want that model? If it's an emergency medicine, yes, it's the best. But for all chronic care, they better look elsewhere. How do you feel today, Kenny?
Gary, if I could turn the camera aside, I'll do the most clumsy flip you'll ever see in your life. But guess what? I'm not in a wheelchair. I'm not disabled in any way. I'm still in my practice doing plumbing, which is incredibly physical, exercising, running, power walking, doing yoga, and just feeling wonderful.
Also, it wasn't just overnight. I remember being there to help you up the steps and take you back down.
Yep.
It took 16 months to finally reverse it. But you were also there with a woman with myasthenia gravis who reversed it. You were there with a woman who had advanced Alzheimer's, couldn't even remember what she ate that morning, and she reversed it. You were there with
what a turnaround she made.
Wasn't it remarkable?
You know what? What was great is that she needed assistance for everything. Not that that was great, but what was great about is when she followed the protocol, as I did, and did everything, she went from that to taking advanced computer classes and functioning completely on her own.
Yeah. And Thomas, remember the engineer, the 70-year-old African-American engineer who was shaking like this on this first day? And then 16 months later, he was steady as a rock and had acute memory and no multiple sclerosis, no Parkinson in his body? You were there. You saw all these people.
I did.
Good. Well, the audience is going to be seeing and hearing more from them. Thank you very much, Kenny. And join us
in
October, Kenny. Come down. You'd be, I'm sure a lot of the people would like to, who are coming to our next retreat, would like to hear from you. That's Kenny. And he is just one of a lot of people who've reversed conditions that medicine says you can't reverse, but they did it. And I just want to mention also that we're going to go to our guest in a second here in the Netherlands. Before we do, our last opportunity for you to join us for either 1, 2, 3, or 4 weeks will be in October for our next retreat. We're really focusing on people who are depressed, who are prematurely aging, who have anxiety, who are overweight, diabetic. People really need to turn their life around and need quality time to do it in a wonderful, beautiful environment. You can go to GaryNall.com, look under retreat, push where it says the villa, and you can see where you're going to be. It's magnificent. We're going to help people. Call 903-881-7008, 903-881-7008, if you'd like more information on the upcoming health retreat. Now let's go over to the Netherlands and say hello to my guest. I gave you his background a little earlier, Chris Casper Ploeg, a Dutch political analyst and freelance journalist and author, and he's done a lot of articles, very important in the Dutch political publications, and in Follow the Money, Dissident Voices in the United States, and Ukraine in the Crossfire, his newest one recently published by Clarity Press. Nice to have you with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Gary.
Chris, very little has been said about the coup in Ukraine that brought a radical right-wing government into power. And we may recall that back in the early 2015, Obama on CNN revealed that the U.S. was involved in the Ukraine crisis from the outset, and that the U.S. had, in Obama's own words, quote, brokered a deal to transition power in Ukraine, end quote. And besides the United States government, other key players behind the coup are the International Monetary Fund, NATO, a certain pro-Western oligarchs in the Ukraine, and then private financial and corporate interest. And I'd like to touch upon these in turn. However, since the U.S. has a pattern of trying to deny the direct strategic involvement in regime change in foreign nations, it would be good for us if you spoke about the U.S. government's involvement with Ukraine's internal politics, particularly with the opposition leaders and groups, to then-President Viktor Yanukovych prior to the coup, and what was the direct role the U.S. played in the regime change, including Hillary Clinton and the most powerful couple in Washington, D.C., as far as neocon, and that is Victoria Nuland, who was Secretary of State Clinton's person overseeing the Ukraine, and her husband is one of the most powerful neocons in the world. Your thoughts, please.
Yeah, right. Good question. So the first thing to mention, though, is when we talk about a coup, I think it's good to emphasize, though, that it also had the change of power also had quite some support within the Ukrainian population, but it was very polarized. So basically, there were actually mass demonstrations in the western and central of Ukraine, and of course, all these actors that you just mentioned were also involved, but there was quite some grassroots support. That being said, it's important to emphasize that Ukraine has been very polarized basically since 1990, its independence, between these more Russian-leaning eastern southern provinces and western and central provinces. And you saw 50-50 support, more or less. So there's that element too. So, but that being said, if we talk about the U.S. influence, I think when we talk about the brokering of the transition of power, one of the key things, of course, to mention is the leaked phone call with Victoria Nuland and the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt, where they more or less discussed very openly who they wanted to have in the interim government. And it more or less exactly worked out the way they discussed it. What's very important to emphasize in this phone call is that they wanted to have Yatsenyuk, a Ukrainian politician, and they wanted to have Klitschko out of the government. And the thing about Klitschko is that he was much more close to Germany. He spoke fluently German, and he also was close to a pro-Russian oligarch. So I think that could be a reason why they didn't want to have him in. And what makes this especially striking is that Klitschko was, at the time, also within Western and Central Ukraine, was by far the most popular opposition politician, pretty much on par with Yanukovych in the East and the Southern provinces, if we look at the latest poll 3 weeks before the regime change. And Yatsenyuk, by contrast, only had 3% support in the poll. So he was not the most democratic choice, so to say. And Yatsenyuk was very much, you know, he became a very hawkish politician, but he was also had very much technocratic credentials. So he was kind of the best guy for the IMF to have. And soon after the regime change, when he became prime minister, he also, you know, proudly said in interviews things like, "I will become the most unpopular prime minister in the history of my country because he will do all these tough reforms that the IMF asks of him." So then about the IMF, of course, this played a crucial role even at the very reasons why all these revolts and unrest happened within Ukraine, because there was an association agreement to be signed with the European Union, and it was tied to an IMF loan. That, of course, comes with its strings attached. And basically, Yanukovych wanted to postpone the signing of the association agreement because he didn't want to have all the austerity, and he wanted to negotiate a better deal. So that's when it all started. Well, then after we had the regime change, before the elections took place, the interim government under Yatsenyuk signed this loan. And what we saw in the first 2 years in Ukraine was just devastating, very devastating austerity policies. So in real terms, education, social welfare, healthcare budgets dropped by 27% to 35%. The minimum wage was frozen for 2 years, and when it finally was raised slightly, it was still, I think, 32% lower than it used to be, also due to inflation, of course. So we see quite devastating austerity policies. Then when you ask me also about U.S. influence after the transition of government, even after the elections, I think it's still very significant. We still had, after the elections in 2015, for example, you had Ukrainian ministers openly talking about U.S. involvement in picking ministers, ministerial posts. Even the head of the security services apparently was being vetted by the U.S. You had talks about Poroshenko meeting every 2 weeks with the U.S. ambassador, where he gave Poroshenko, quote, firm orders. Especially when we had a cabinet crisis in 2016, because indeed, as Yatsenyuk said, he did become one of the most unpopular prime ministers in the history of his country. And he didn't even participate in the local elections at the end of 2015 because he barely would get any votes. So there was a vote to oust his party from the cabinet and oust him. And Poroshenko publicly supported this vote, and then at the last minute, his party basically made a U-turn. And what we know from reports in very pro-Western liberal newspapers within Ukraine is that basically the U.S. pressured him to not support the vote, and they ousted him later. Later, Yatsenyuk resigned by himself, but that would mean that not the entire cabinet would have to, his entire party would have to leave the cabinet. So basically what we see here, and by the way, one of these newspapers actually called Poroshenko an American puppet. So this is coming from pro-Western liberal newspapers within Ukraine. So I think it's quite obvious that there has been tremendous leverage that the U.S. has had in Ukraine. So this relates, of course, to the austerity policies. I mean, Joe Biden, for example, gave speeches in Parliament very much emphasizing that these have to be implemented. But this also relates to the war in the east of Ukraine and the support for the Minsk peace accords and the process there, because we also know from leaks within German intelligence and French intelligence, Der Spiegel, for example, in 2015 published an extensive report that many German diplomats were frustrated with the U.S. because every time U.S. diplomats had visited Ukraine, suddenly Ukrainian politicians were much more likely to support the war efforts, and that to, you know, bring them back to the negotiation process. They were complaining about propaganda, their words, coming out of NATO offices, which is very much dominated by U.S. intelligence. Similar complaints were issued by French intelligence and French Parliament, complaints about the U.S. intelligence not making any sense. So, yeah, on a number of levels, I think the U.S. influence has been quite blatant and very much also negative, yes.
Chris, what are some of the natural resources that the United States would covet, that they would want, that would spur them into regime change?
Right. So, okay, Ukraine has the potential to become a very prosperous country. It has a lot of black earth soil, very good for agriculture. It has natural gas as well. That being said, I'm not sure if that's one of the key reasons for wanting regime change. A lot of it, for example, is in close to the war zone, which is very hard, obviously, to exploit in this state. Some of it was also in Crimea, by the way. Personally, I think the regime change is less about profiteering motives, although that will probably be there too. I mean, one good example is The son of Joe Biden, Hunter Biden, and a number of other politicians connected to the Democratic establishment in 2014, soon after the regime change, getting all of these positions in the board of Burisma Holdings, a company connected to a very notoriously criminal oligarch called Igor Kolomoisky, who kind of positioned himself as a great patriot against Russia and as such. And also is also a funder of many of these far-right militia groups. But that being said, I think it's more motivated by these kind of Cold War mentality, anti-Russian mentality. Also because a lot of the enterprises within Ukraine, the most profitable state-run enterprises, had already been privatized in the 1990s. And 2000s and have already been in hands of the national oligarchy. So, yeah, there have been massive privatization programs also going on. They announced, I think, 2000s for sale, 350 or something were already put for sale. But, you know, the sales weren't even going that well because many of them weren't that profitable. So personally, my take is that it's more motivated by anti-Russian motives. So, for example, if you look at the people who first designed the so-called European Eastern Partnership Initiative, which was also where the association agreement with Ukraine came out of, that was Władysław Sikorski in Poland and Carl Bildt from Sweden. And both of these politicians have quite extensive ties to neocon circles within the U.S., and yeah, so that's where that came out of. If you also look at one lecture George Friedman gave, the chief intelligence overseer from Stratfor, one of the most prominent U.S. intelligence private contractors, at the Foreign Affairs, the Council of Foreign Relations platform. And he basically said that his take on it is that the United States wanted to prevent a German-Russian alliance from taking place with German technology and capital, forming an alliance with Russian natural resources and labor. Of course, you can put some critical notes on how realistic it is that such an alliance would become a major policy driver. I think some of it might be exaggerated fears within in the U.S. policy circles, but I think it definitely is a motivator. You do see, since the crisis happened, a lot of tension within between Europe and Russia.
Chris, I have one final thought. If you could give me a short answer on this, what you're telling us, no one in the American media has said. We've been told only that Russia invaded Ukraine and that started a war. It's all Russia's fault. That's why we can't trust Russia. That's why Vladimir Putin is being equated to Adolf Hitler. And yet the American media has failed to visit there to see that had the Ukrainian people taken the International Monetary Fund loan when it was originally offered, they would have gone through the same reductions in pensions, the same high cost of living, and they would have ended up poorer than ever, just like people in Greece do. And yet they're never telling that side of the story. Your final thoughts?
Yeah, well, actually, this is a good point. If you look at polls in 2015, only 25% of the population wanted to have economic reforms, if that would mean a lowering of living standards. And the latest Gallup poll in 2017, in March, I believe it was, basically said that 47% of the Ukrainian population now struggles to afford food for themselves or their family at some points in the year, which is just devastating. This is very undemocratic, and I think one of the reasons also that all these war efforts and this anti-Russian nationalism within Ukraine and within the West is being propped up is also to distract from this horrific economic policies. That being said, of course, I mean, there are some things to say about Russia as well. They have been supporting the rebels They have, of course, annexed Crimea, although it did have local support to a large extent, but it did help to fuel the kind of war rhetoric. But yeah, I mean, very obviously, I think Russia has been, and you can, you know, I'm not even saying necessarily that this is justified, that you need to cut a quick, clear distinction between justification and motivation, but it's very clear that Russia is motivated in large parts by security concerns, and they have been voicing these concerns for years. Just in 2008, for example, when the NATO summit wanted to invite the Ukraine into NATO. 2 months before that, we have a cable leaked by WikiLeaks from the U.S. ambassador in Russia with direct precedence to Washington, basically predicting everything that happened, saying that the Russian foreign minister Lavrov was very concerned about the country getting polarized, even potentially getting into civil war, and that it would force Russia to decide whether to intervene or not. So these were, to some extent, very foreseeable events. And of course, you know, Russia is becoming more militaristic. It's spending a lot on defense in terms of a percentage of its budget. But then if you compare it in absolute figures with NATO, there's just no comparison. Total NATO military budget is almost 10 times that of the CSCO, which is Russia's mutual defense alliance with some former Soviet countries. Chris, even if you would add China and Iran, just for the sake of argument, it would still be three times as large.
Many of us,
and then we haven't even talked about nuclear escalations. I don't know if I have time to.
That will be for a different conversation. We're going to invite you back for another in-depth conversation because the American public has not been told the truth. They have not been told why the United States and Secretary of State Clinton and Barack Obama wanted to destabilize that whole area of the Ukraine so that it puts Russia in a defensive position, and it also exploits the natural resources and the capital of the Ukrainian people. Thank you very much for being on. We look forward to our next conversation. Chris Casper de Ploeg, and from the Netherlands, and the author of Ukraine in the Crossfire. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for watching. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.